The value here, people often are puzzled about, well, what are they actually selling? What they're selling, what brands are interested in, is the value of the community connection that has been created by this creator and sustained by community interactions. That's what brands are interested in.
And now it's time for another How Do You Like It So Far? A podcast about popular culture and a changing world. I'm Henry Jenkins.
And I'm Colin McClay. Today we are joined by two amazing guests, our friends and colleagues, David Craig, who is a professor here at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, also an Emmy-nominated Hollywood producer and an activist where he's been involved in a long time in the LGBTQ community. His co-author is Stuart Cunningham, who is a super eminent and fancy professor at the Queensland University of Technology in Australia. He is recognized for his contributions to media, communication, cultural studies, the future of humanities, and just about everything else, especially as they pertain to industry practice and government policy.
And they're authors of a recent book called Social Media Entertainment, The New Intersection of Hollywood and Silicon Valley, which is what we're going to be talking to them about today.
They've traversed the world interviewing hundreds of people and have unearthed what to many of us is hugely surprising and enlightening phenomenon. Although to youth and others who are involved in this social media entertainment culture and subculture and communities, it may not come as such a surprise. So we are thrilled to have them in studio today.
I want us to sort of map this intersection your book is talking about. And one snapshot might be NBC's recent announcement that YouTube celebrity Lily Singh will be replacing Carson Daly as the late-night television talk show host, making her first Asian-American woman to have that position and the first YouTube star to move into that slot.
I am so excited to finally tell you about something I have been working on since literally forever, and that is that your girl is getting her own TV show! That's right, your girl is getting her own NBC.
What does that show us about this intersection you're talking about?
Well, increasingly we find that whereas all Hollywood and really all media industries globally are converging to reference perhaps... converging on media and video platforms like Netflix and Hulu... It's also the case that this other industry that has nurtured the rise of creators, which we refer to that could are also coined as influencers and bloggers, YouTubers, game players, etc., have become vital to the way this industry operates. To quote yet again, whenever a new media industry comes along, the older media industries adapt accordingly. And we have seen numerous instances where, in many ways, this new industry is retro-engineered the way TV operates. If you look at things like James Corden's Carpool Karaoke, and many of the late-night talk show hosts have been the first to, and daytime comedians like Ellen, have been the first to understand this as a separate place, but one that is also monetizable for their industries and their brand. But this isn't the first time now that a creator has been recruited over into traditional media. In fact, this is now one of numerous instances. Hannah Hart had a cooking show. There wasn't even a talk show on E for a brief minute. The question that we have to wonder here, and in many ways we see these industries actually less twined and less of an overlapping Venn diagram and growing in some ways further apart here in the U.S. at least, is who is... Lily Singh's community. Lily Singh has 16 million members of her fan community across numerous platforms, of which the vast majority of them are not only outside of the U.S., but don't subscribe to television and would not entertain buying a cable or satellite subscription to watch her do a late-night talk show host, to do the sort of thing that they've been spending time with her doing every day for the last 12 years that she's been nurturing and building her creator business. So it is one that, look, greater minds and more creative minds than ours might have something else they understand, and this could very well be a leading driver of Comcast streaming video play, which is a would be relatively smart in the impending streaming wars we're facing. But I'm not 100% convinced that, and we haven't seen a lot of great evidence that these creators have been able to then bring their community and their value to legacy media because they represent something quite distinct and different. They are a different form of social talent as opposed to your typical kind of traditional media talent.
Well, so, I mean, this is a remarkable story and you've just made it that much more interesting. But I think for all of us, maybe starting by what the dynamics of her kind of process and community and engagement with that sort of not even just fan base, but people that she interacts with pre late night talk show, you know, like let's talk about the before and what that looked like and how that might have been experienced. And then we can talk about the way that that's different as she gets onto television, right? And the sort of split in communities that you just mentioned and whether, you know, how those dynamics change and what the implications are for her ability to engage with her community, whether because of the limitations of technology or culture or whatever else, which seems like the interesting question is how do those things bridge or not bridge or talk to each other? But we got to go to the origins first, sure. It feels like.
So Lily is very much a prototype of what we've witnessed both at the mid-level and at the very high globally superstar successful careers that these creators have created. Her code name is Superwoman, which is in and of itself a pretty brazen, bold kind of position. But I bring this up a lot in my class. I ask, how many of you grew up watching the story of what it was like to grow up as a Canadian Indian bisexual woman in the 90s and the aughts? And of course, everyone looks at me utterly flummoxed until I say, well, that's what Lily has crafted, was a career of being able to convince people across platforms around the world to hang out and find out what it was like to go through her experiences, which turned out to be not only incredibly relatable around the world, but also quite brilliantly funny and personable. And she has this force and strength of personality.
You've ever done any way that you've included me in your day has made such a difference. Wait, don't play me out. I'd like to thank all the women who have ever come before me in terms of having their own show, in terms of
entertainment. And what she's managed to do, which is the kind of crux of where we lie around our work, is she's used that affinity and that relationship she's nurtured with her fan community across these platforms and over time into numerous business models. So she's had number one best-selling books. She sold out tours around the world. There's a great story of how she showed up on a YouTube tour in Mumbai. And one of the, if not the biggest Bollywood movie star in the world, lived around the corner, and his son said, I want to go see Lily Singh. He had no idea who this woman was, but took the son down the street to the concert or to the venue, and no one even knew who he was. They were all there for Lily. And it was a story we heard, what, at least a half dozen times in Mumbai. And this was a signal to him that this was, we're witnessing a huge epochal shift in the way pop culture operates because of the way these creators have harnessed these platforms for what these platforms do differently from traditional media.
And that's a perfect example of the different practices between main media and social media entertainment. So in our work, in our talking with creators and with those who've sought to manage them, it's very clear that they spend at least half of their time managing their community, reacting to them, responding to them, liking, sharing, actually being there. Even some of the leading creators will insist that they continue to do that. So there's this radical difference in terms of the division of labor. These people are producers, but they're also directors, actors, editors. They're above the line as well as below the line. They're marketers, they're entrepreneurs. They act on stage, but they also sell the tickets. I think we say that, use that phrase. So it's a very different mode of engagement. And the value here, people often are puzzled about, well, what are they actually selling? What they're selling, what brands are interested in, is the value of the community connection that has been created by this creator and sustained by community interactions. That's what brands are interested in. they're not interested in the person themselves, but in obviously what that person has brought to, and in the case of literally millions of these creators, millions of followers. There's at least 4,500 YouTubers alone who have a million or more followers, subscribers. And that figure is climbing all the time. I'm sure that's dated. That was our 2017.
I was going to say that was 10 minutes ago. Now it's already gone.
That was and of course the book was finished in 2017. So you know it's
timely.
We're updating rapidly all the time.
So the old myth of stardom was you got discovered in Schwab's drugstore by Hollywood producer who then pumps up your aura, your image, and you become a big screen star. The new one seems to be you can make a video in your bedroom and post it on YouTube and suddenly the world beats a path to your doorstep. Mm. So we know more or less the downsides of the Hollywood star myth. Mm. What's the upsides and downsides of trying to become a YouTube celebrity from the privacy of your teenage bedroom?
Well, we hate to continue to quote you, Henry, but one of the things that you and your collaborators do in Spreadable Media is to talk against the notion of virality. The notion that somehow magically, you know, a YouTuber loads some content and magically they become famous. Well, that's like the Hollywood myth. It's the idea that for no reason, or it seems no reason except, for instance, you know, that person might have been, you know, very beautiful and the Hollywood exec comes in and decides to make them a star. The question of virality, the question of how does one become a successful YouTuber is now highly codified, and it's become more and more codified. There's a piece of work by a German scholar in the journal Convergence a few years ago that did some big data analytics on on YouTube and said, okay, 85% of views are concentrated on 3% of creators, and also made the observation that those who've been in the game for longer have the first mover advantage, and it's much harder to be known above the noise now. And that's something that we've certainly encountered. So the downsides are that it's a very crowded field. The upsides are that it remains a space, a cultural production space and a communication space that has very, very, very low barriers to entry. That hasn't changed. But the codification process that I referred to earlier is really so that people can test more quickly whether they are, whether it's worth it for them. And so there's an awful lot of work that goes on platforms, and YouTube remains the prototypical platform here, I suppose, with its Creator Academy that you can go to online, its YouTube Spaces, where if you're 10,000 followers or more, you can start to get some kinds of assistance through networking and through the actual production facilities in the YouTube Spaces, of which there are about a dozen around the world now. And the more successful you are, the more the white gloves come out, the more you are managed more closely, more carefully. And so if you're a million plus subscribers, then you're going to have, you know, a manager if you're a YouTuber, for example. And the same thing happens with Instagram, et cetera.
So you just mentioned sort of one type of experimentation and learning. Can I make it? Right? You know, do I resonate with this community? And I can know, there's no barrier to entry. I can know pretty quickly, can I build a following? Can I engage a community, create a community? What about experimentation with the way that people engage their community? So you, going back a step, you were sort of talking about the reason that brands are interested, not just in the star, but in the network that they've built and in the ethos and the feel around it. So that can be used to sell things, products, but it can also be used to engage around ideas, around action, around social change, and the things that, you know, sort of the things that motivated David before and that motivate many of us to say, how do we make the world a better place? How do we serve our communities? So I'm curious what room there is, and thinking about, you know, sort of Hollywood or mass entertainment, there are limits to what you can do because you make a mistake and boom, you're out of there, versus wondering how playful and experimental they can be in these communities, which are perhaps warmer, on maybe crossing various platforms. And what does it mean for someone in that setting to experiment and to take risks?
As I want to do, I just want to also qualify. We started off looking at YouTubers. What we quickly came to understand was this was a multi-platform space and multimodal space. So there are most, if not all, aspiring YouTube creators are in fact also have an Instagram and Snap and sometimes Tumblr, Pinterest, even now LinkedIn. And the proliferation of platforms in many ways are used to not only further extend and aggregate and engage their community, but to monetize their brand. So we tend to sometimes fall into the trap of calling them YouTubers, but in many ways this is, especially when in the work we've done outside of the country, where access to video and affordable access to video is often limited. The most successful creators in those areas, in those countries, are often either on Instagram because photos are relatively easy to upload, or even on Twitter. And this is a dynamic that constantly changes, but even if they are successful more or launch their careers in one platform, they almost always harness other platforms to do two other things. Besides generating revenue, it is, of course, to engage the community with the features and affordances, to borrow a term, of what the platforms all do differently. Mm-hmm. Whereas NBC is not that different from ABC. Facebook could not be more different from YouTube. Even as they've converged around video, they still very much operate in different ways. And these creators almost have an intuitive understanding. We like to sometimes say it's not about millennials and Gen Z. It's about the digital media generation versus the social media generation. And we think the distance between those two are even more profound than they were between the analog, which is me, old man David. And we think that it's vital because you can see this even in our students. The 28-year-old thinks we're making it up, and the 24-year-old thinks doesn't understand what the question is. The second point to make, and this is one that we're very sensitive to, is that when you have platforms that scale at 2 billion for YouTube, 2 billion for Facebook, 1 billion for Instagram, even TikTok now has managed to secure almost half a billion around the world, and that's the Chinese-owned, ByteDance-owned company. There are an unbelievable array of extremely bad players operating in this space, taking advantage and exploiting what these platforms can do, and particularly in this creator space, we see rampant amounts of abuse and exploitation. But we've been privileged by the nature of the work that we did, getting on the ground in doing over 200 interviews in over 25 cities and 10 countries, to almost bear witness to the fact that creators have an intuitive understanding that they don't just use their community. They are a member of their community and therefore represent the values, identities, affinities, ideologies, and interests of that community, and are held accountable not only by that community, but by the brand that then wants to use them to get to that community. So more often than not, the creators will walk away from brand deals that are in violation of what they understand their community cares about, because they are members of that community. The other thing that, again, as an old-timey activist, was the remarkable amount of advocacy, and on a continuum from just extraordinary multicultural forms of representation, the likes of which we've never seen before, all the way through to cultural pedagogy and advocacy, to overtly political forms of cultural progressivity. So we saw, for example, during the 2016 elections, people like Casey Neistat and Ingrid Nilsson basically coming out and advocating for the left, for candidates on the left, for Democrats, for Hillary, after the elections, risking at great peril brand deals and relationships with vast swaths of their community to take a stand around political issues. And we interviewed a number of Asian Americans, many of whom came into this rather benignly, saying, oh, I just stumbled into somehow making this into a brand and a career and a business. But I came to understand I also now operate as a bit of a role model for an underserved and underrepresented community. So while we're celebrating Crazy Rich Asians this year, there have been Crazy Rich Asian Americans who've been doing extraordinarily well and also responsibly well on these platforms, advocating for and representing and promoting Asian American culture, the likes of which the world hasn't really ever really been exposed to, certainly around queer representation. We saw many different types of practices, people who came out online openly queer and very much willing to promote and represent who they are. But what was fascinating for us were the likes of Ingrid Nilsson, who had already secured a 3-year deal as a Clairol Glam ambassador when she risked it all to come out to her community at that point. I think it was maybe 6 to 7 million to say, I need to let you know I am a lesbian and I'm proud of that. But it was extraordinary. I mean, this was something unique in the coming out journey that most queer peoples go through. And yes, while we still see many forms of structural inequality that replicate the conditions out in the real world, when we contrast it next to, for example, the struggles I had as an openly gay man trying to promote queer-themed content in legacy media, which was in and of itself a complex space and perhaps more successful than many other forms of representation, this was something for us to champion and to say, well, let's also recognize the power and the potential and the progressivity and multiculturalism that's occurring in this space. We've now extended this work into other forms of community, Arab Muslim pop culture and Arab Muslim creators out of Dearborn, Michigan, of all places, in many ways. Young women trying to support themselves through this work while simultaneously factoring into the global debates around gender and faith. And this sort of thing is exhilarating, of course, highly precarious, and one that comes fraught with any number of rampant ways that this could go horribly awry. But again, the core of our work was contrasting the way in which power is being harnessed by these creators around social concerns relative to what we have seen in over 100 years of the way media industries have typically operated and cared and foreground these issues.
I think just to pick up on your question, Colin, was about experimentation. So the heart of this book is, what cultural progressivity can we find in these newly commercializing spaces? So they're both new spaces. I mean, this industry, social media entertainment, is only 12 years old. It starts in 2006 with Google's purchase of YouTube and goes on from there. So it's 12 and a bit years old. It's very, very young. So the whole thing is experimental in many ways. People ask us, what's it going to be like in 10 years? Well, you know, who knows? But the point about, there's so much volatility, there is so much precariousness for creators, but that's because it's not just a case of, well, you've got an authentic creator in a commercializing space and that's a zero-sum game. So the more commercial, the less authentic. That's the way in which a lot of critical studies, academic studies, might approach the question. As soon as you introduce a commercializing dynamic, then you are automatically threatened with, you know, you've got problems of being authentic to yourself. What we've introduced into this is a third term, which is community. So the ways in which a creator brings into life a community, a following, a subscriber base, a fan base, that's the value that a brand might be interested in. But the creator-community relationship is the primary one. And the brand is only interested in it because we have that relationship. So the test of authenticity, the test of successful experimentation, the test of cultural progressivity in this space is one that has to be temporalized. You have to think about it over time because it's not something that's just established once and for all. It's being tested all the time in real time as community says to creator, well, you've gone too far with these brand deals, or the brands want to push back on the ways in which a creator won't toe the line because of their relationship with the community. So there's a discipline. Mm. So brands seek to discipline creators. Communities seek to discipline creators. Communities seek to discipline brands. You know, we don't like the way that you've set up this relationship, so we're going to speak back. So it's a three-part relationship, and that's what makes it so volatile. I mean, keeping those three balls, if you like, in the air over time, we spend a chapter in the book talking about some examples of those who've worked in the industry for a long time and for whom, even if they've been quite successful, the ability to fail, the ability for those relationships to break down is ever present.
So let's bring this back to the human scale. So let's picture this Arab American girl from Dearborn, Michigan that you're talking about. Maybe she's 19, 20, doing her undergraduate degree. And you're describing her as dealing with pressure from community, pressure from platform, pressure from brands. Is she ready to deal with that pressure? What support system does she have around her as she's working through these fairly complex economic and political relationships?
Right. Well, we've certainly seen featured a lot of discussion recently about creator burnout and the lack of well-being and support. We mean this quite literally. Creators are having midlife crises at the age of 22, but that's because in many instances, they've been doing this since they were quite young, in some cases even younger. And it is untenably difficult to maintain the growth of their community and their business while the platforms repeatedly change. Now we have regulation now rightfully entering into and starting to add some layers of governance around this. And of course, the ongoing pressures around advertising and brand issues. And the truth of the matter is there isn't a lot of support, but the support that she namely mentioned in our interview was from her community that stayed loyal. I won't go into the details, but she, at the same time that the community taketh away, the community also giveth. And this is, again, the fundamental nature of what Nancy Bain refers to as relational labor, but we call it more community management. So much of their identity work that they're doing on these platforms is because they find shared affinity and they find communities that are very eager to finally see these forms of representation, these types of practices, and this sort of recognition. So even as they do walk a tightrope, and it is quite challenging, it is also the case that they are as beholden, but as also supported and emboldened by their community. And that's the closest we can see to any sort of structures. In fairness, coming from Hollywood, I'm not sure that we had any mechanisms for support for the sort of toxicity and exploitation and abuse. And there are now, you know, legend. A lot of the stories we do know of Hollywood actually aren't based in myth, but in fact. And these human scale issues are being played out now across platforms reaching 2 billion people and providing the means for representation and voice, but also posing all sorts of questions we still are wrestling with around the nature of capital and commerce and identity and ideology.
You'll know very well, Henry, because you've written about it, the Vlog Brothers, Hank and John Green, very well known players, indeed thought leaders in this field. And the question of welfare, of the ways in which people can support each other in this industry is central to their practice. So with the nerd fighters who form chapters around the world, I mean, there are literally thousands of chapters of nerd fighters in high schools, universities, and they look out for each other. I mean, there's a lot of welfare that goes on at the peer-to-peer level. The creator themselves, I mean, Hank and John Green might be the Vlog Brothers, but the nerd fighters are a whole swathe of chapters who are self-organizing, who really are looking out for each other because, as the name implies, nerd fighters are those people who may not fit in very easily in their schools or in their higher education, and they look to each other. I think that those are some of the really great outstanding examples, but then there's also the more formal support for creators that you see with the Internet Creators Guild. Admittedly, a small group, but one with real punch at the leadership level in terms of engaging around some of the factors that lead to demonetization of content that increase hugely the stress and precariousness of people's careers online.
So maybe we should talk a little bit more about that. I mean, David, you've followed the adpocalypse at length. But so you guys have just spun the story of this remarkable, growing, powerful, in social, cultural, economic terms, this really vibrant space. But it feels like at times they get the white glove service. Mm. And at other times, maybe they're an afterthought, or that the platforms or other regulatory forces, whether in the small or big P, are not necessarily focusing on them. And, you know, I hear the same burnout we're hearing about now in podcasting, but it seems like a sort of a bleeding edge of something like either the gig economy or of artists as we've always known them, but sort of a new representation of or a new form perhaps of some old things that we've questioned. And in a moment where, you know, there's sort of an absence of many social safety nets, but also the unpredictability of the technology platforms and the way they work now. So a lot of stress points in there. And so I guess I wondered if I could invite you to speak a little bit about some of those stress points, what we can do about them, how we should think about them.
Well, we end the book with a plea for creator advocacy. That's our final sign-off in the book, where we draw attention to the fact that in this coming regulatory era, we call it a new regulatory era, which is much, much more formed now than when we finished the book in 2017. We know that a lot of this is, it's inevitable that these platforms need to both govern themselves far better, as well as will need the state to step in to encourage that better self-regulation. And there are many instances, obviously, in the European Union most particularly, but also in other countries. In my country, for example, there's a very, very extensive inquiry that has recommended an algorithm regulator to be able to require platforms to report much more transparently the ways in which they allocate advertising so that they don't preference themselves, and that they, for example, give back much more to, say, you know, journalistic content, which is its own huge crisis. This coming regulatory era is one where we're seeing big titanic forces at work, where the state is rumbling into action. Even the US may, you know, there's a lot of inquiries going on here as well. Unlikely that we'll see it under the current administration, but we've got Elizabeth Warren, one of the people declared for the Democratic presidential race this year and next, saying tech titans should be broken up. So laying very clearly on the table a nuclear response to the problems of platform governance. There are many other issues being debated around greater platform governance. One of the problems that we want to insert into this coming regulatory era is that all of these movements are about the concerns for citizenry, the concerns for consumers, the concerns for traditional media and journalism sustainability, but very little about creators of the sort that we've been tracking in this book. Very, very little concern for them. In fact, they're often seen as part of the problem, not part of the positive aspects of platform, the space that platforms have facilitated. In fact, it's very hard to hear very much positive about platforms at all in the current environment. And creators are being treated as a byproduct of that uniform negativity that's now swelling to a regulatory rumble.
So thank you for plugging our policy conference coming up at the end of May at American University, where we hope to try to engage with activists, advocates, policymakers, platform executives, and of course creators around these very concerns, which is we hold a pretty strong position. Platforms need to be regulated and better self-regulated, as do creators. The truth is we aren't seeing a lot of attention made to the fact that we believe cultural producers operating across these platforms may also deserve some rights and be afforded some recognition in the way in which they are also stakeholders in this environment. And to pivot a little bit, the example that we would also cite is the way in which creator regulation has been played out in China. Where, in fact, not only are they nurturing behind their great Chinese firewall a very, very potent and accelerated and very appreciably powerful array of platforms and a more competitive and more advanced platform landscape, which are the envy of our platforms, which is in many ways why Zuckerberg is pivoting to the WeChat model with Facebook. But they have been both censoring, as they are wont to do around any cultural production, but also championing their creator class. The Wang Hong economy, as has been coined in the Chinese press, refers to the extraordinary power, economic power, that they believe creators have to help nurture and facilitate their transformation into a digital economy. And so you have, for example, in Wuhan, they've built a small town where commercial live streamers can live and work all day long, located next to a European theme park, medieval theme park. So they literally have a, you know, a Dutch windmill behind them, but it's quite fascinating. You see them in many ways encouraging the sort of economic activity that creators are doing, particularly through the advanced acceleration and integration of their e-commerce platforms that have just leapfrogged over what any of our platforms are doing here, along with online mobile payment systems and virtual goods and a whole raft of other very important critical and cultural distinctions between these two competing industries. But we're now seeing that these platforms, nurtured by their creators, are leapfrogging out and over the wall. And so the fastest growing tech company in the world is ByteDance, which owns a number of these social media platforms on which creators have been very successful. And that includes their acquisition of Musical.ly 3 years ago, which they overnight turned into a companion to their own TikTok platform. And creators there are championing their ability to yet again harness a new platform to represent not only their culture, but monetize their community. So it's not only the case that Western governance doesn't have much regard or recognition of what creators are doing. It's that in an impending set of conditions that we see ourselves facing with the Chinese competing system, they've got the lead. We see them as very much more advanced and accelerated, and there's something we ought to at least be aware of there. We're not in any way suggesting that we replicate the same regulatory conditions, but we ought to be aware that they see these as drivers of economic growth.
As an example of a highly interventionist, highly sensorial, but also highly creative policy, China can't be beaten. I mean, so they're working on part of the current five-year plan is Internet Plus. Internet Plus is about how to embed digital life way down into the into the roots of society. Most of what we hear about that is about, you know, the social credit system and the apocalyptic surveillance scenarios that might be unfolding. Of course, these are very possible, but as well as those, Internet Plus is about making sure that people have jobs. So the one thing that the Chinese state is scared about, without any question, is rising unemployment. The economy is slowing, and it may be reaching a serious point where white-collar workers are now being laid off. These phenomena, you know, the Wuhan streamer village, etc., are examples of where the state at a provincial or local or national level are treating this industry more seriously than anywhere else in the world, treating it as an industry that can absorb labor, that can inspire, but needs to be surveilled very carefully. And there are plenty of examples of hardcore state crackdown on, you know, social morality grounds. But at the same time, nurturing it and looking to it as a serious industry that can be both culturally expressive and deal with questions of social inequity, rural versus urban divides, and work opportunity.
So the title of your book emphasizes a particular kind of creative geography, right? The intersection of Hollywood and Silicon Valley. Both of those are used shorthand to tie to creative cities to think about how production works. But listening to you, first of all, it's much more dispersed and decentered than that, right? Mm. It can just as much Dearborn, Michigan as it is Silicon Valley. And sure. Beyond that, you're describing a kind of global ecology where it's not Hollywood anymore as a national cinema. It's a global media industry where stars can emerge almost anywhere and become, as far as their language is accessible to people, can become celebrities in other parts of the world.
Not Hollywood was one of the titles we considered, but it was taken already. So, yeah.
So can you say a little more about how this relates to older arguments about creative cities and production hubs? And
It has a lot to say to those, because if you take a couple of pieces of data that we use, 80% of YouTube views comes from outside the US. So, okay, the US may well be the center of this industry, but the consumption base is way larger, way larger. And 60% of all views come from countries other than where the creator is located. Mm. So the level of international spread, every creator has people who follow them in dozens of countries. In my country, Australia, it's at 90%. That's partly because it's a small country with a small, relatively small population and English language. But 9 out of 10 views of Australian creators come from outside the country. So the level of globalism here is probably, we would argue, without precedent. And the reason why we say that is that if you were to compare social media entertainment and the way it travels around the world to, say, Netflix or Amazon Prime, which are in 190 countries around the world, virtually universal, except, of course, for China, they have to negotiate on a territory-by-territory basis the rights to their back catalogue. And so the Netflix back catalogue is vastly different every territory you go to. The Australian Netflix catalogue is five times smaller than the US catalogue. So compare that to this kind of content that someone can create in their bedroom and can, as soon as it's uploaded, can reach a far wider potential viewership and indeed real viewership, because the numbers here are pretty astonishing. We're talking about, you know, as I said earlier, 4,500, just to take YouTube, noting always David's point about it's all multi-platform now, but 4,500 and growing all the time with 1 million subscribers or more around the world. So the fact that this can happen has got a lot to do with the question of IP, because this gets into what happened with Content ID back in the early days, where if you were ever going to be able to make money on YouTube, then your content needed to be to have no infringing material on it. That enables the platforms to distribute it globally on the basis that they're not responsible for the content. If there is any infringement or any other issues that people draw to their attention, then as long as they responsibly take down or respond to that, then that's the core of the safe harbor provisions, the carriage content distinction. And that's what makes the platforms, of course, so radically different from main media. Main media is all about the creation, retention, and enforcement of IP. In social media entertainment, content travels the world without those protections. Traditional IP comes in at other levels for creators around book deals or merchandising, all the other ways in which they make money.
But it's not the core of what they're trying to do.
It's not the core of the content production and distribution process.
Yeah.
And that's what makes Henry's point about, of course, Silicon Valley and Hollywood are just places that we use to talk about the vastly different business cultures that have when you put those two different business cultures in a convergent vortex, that's what you get. You get this very volatile, but extremely interesting and experimental phenomenon that we call social media entertainment.
When you look at the leading creators in various verticals, you've got, for example, not just Michelle Phan, who had not only been extraordinary in turning her beauty brand into a global brand and now has launched her own Chinese version of the Michelle Phan business. But you've got Dubai-based beauty vloggers who sell out their products in Australia in 8 seconds. You've got Chiara Ferragni, who's the biggest of them all based out of Italy, but who has never walked the runway in Milan. And that's only within those one set of verticals. I hesitate to mention the name PewDiePie, but he is a Swedish-born guy who operates from his apartment in the south of England with a team of people supporting and behind him. But he, in fact, is not the most lucrative in the gameplay space, if you want to even qualify him in that way. That's kind of reductive because he does obviously more diverse and now rapidly changing kinds of content. But Markiplier and Ninja are wildly successful game players in that in their verticals, who I don't know where they live. I suspect they may be LA-based, if only because they can afford to live in a beautiful sunny place and have all sorts of access to the benefits of Southern California, but they aren't necessarily here. And this is coming up repeatedly in our research. Even those living in Hollywood were not here because they were using this as a calling card. This was not a way to break into Hollywood. More often than not, they found that to be a loss leader. They were wasting their time playing a character on a Disney show that didn't in any way resemble the person that they have built a brand around on these platforms. But when we started to then get into other countries and see the breadth of the communities and representational practices and types of content, when you have, you know, rural Indian housewives generating vast swaths of revenue by sharing their family cooking recipes online that would have otherwise passed away with them, when you see Joburg-based creators advocating for a Southern African sort of lifestyle culture that isn't in response to the way Western depictions of African culture are, but rather in response to the Pan-Africanism of Nigerian and Nollywood culture that has often been kind of reductive in saying this is when they have the richest and perhaps the most diverse kinds of cultural forms in the world that we've rarely witnessed abroad. When you see the breadth of what's happening outside of creative cities and outside of the, if you will, the homes of legacy media industries, whether Bollywood, Nollywood, or Hollywood, it's pretty remarkable. It's also a challenge for us as academics and scholars to understand the breadth and scale of that diversity. Again, I go back to the fact, yes, we are quite terrified by the sort of abuses that we see, not only on the platforms, but within the creator space. But we're also quite awed by the way in which particularly young people are harnessing these platforms to speak to forms of identity that we've never been given witness to and rarely exposed to. In many ways, it's almost over-indexing in this space because they've been so denied a seat at the table before. And that to us is something to both advocate for while we still very much understand there needs to be certain safeguards and protections in place.
So with an eye to supporting the continued, you know, vibrance of that global, that story that you just told, which is super compelling, we recognize there's another side to it, right, that you've acknowledged of sort of bad actors, either as platforms or as personalities. How do we think about them, and how do we think about putting the brakes on negative stuff without undermining this really promising set of kind of empowering human and community-based stories? So I feel like we need some, even if you don't have the answers, how do we start to even have that conversation and understand?
Yeah, so, I mean, as we think of the snapshots, the news reports of the attack on the mosque in New Zealand loom large, where we both had terrorists live streaming their attacks and citing PewDiePie and other influencers as inspirations for what they did.
Right. So the two references here would be as a queer activist for 40 years who was part of a movement that borrowed from the and stood on the shoulders of other movements. What you understood is that you need to carry both a shield and a sword, and that that activism is important, that we find and build and nurture alliances with progressive and conscientious allies, both at the platforms as well as in government, who will step in and start to look at how we more effectively monitor and correct and prevent these sorts of practices from occurring. But we also understood as queer activists, all the way back to shortly after Stonewall, that you also need to operate in a reform mode to go in and try to exact change from within simultaneously. If all you do is vilify and demonize and want to shut down the whole thing, what you do is you also end up severing whatever progressive media power there was. So as a early board member of GLAAD and who used to be involved in programming of GLAAD, I would lead protests out in front of the studios. At the same time, I would be pitching them more progressive queer representations and projects during at the same time. So it is a two-pronged sword that we think we need to. But if we're not even, let's just say one of the challenges that we have is we know that in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, if you click, it sticks as well. And in many ways, the sort of horrific and tragic events that we're witnessing, that in many ways have some connection to this creator culture that we're witnessing, is unquestionably dire and serious. But you're not going to necessarily get the same amount of print. I'll give you the examples just this past weekend. There was, in response to what occurred horribly in New Zealand, there was, of course, a short, small, unfortunate, little mention, but important mention of the rise of young students going on protest around the world on behalf in regards to climate change. Now, whereas every single article about the New Zealand referenced PewDiePie and live streaming and Facebook, the articles about students globally stepping out of school to protest didn't even mention social media at all. And so what we see is this kind of negative space that's occurred, where there is almost a preclusion, a resistance to even referencing or nuancing the fact that there are, as another example, the case of the Parkland teenagers or AOC, who understand how to also harness these platforms and this technology to do something quite profound. So we are fully in support of finding ways to find sophisticated responses to this. What we're anxious about is that these voices from the margins and these progressive voices will be severed because they're not even being acknowledged.
And there's a very important point to make here, and that is that main media, not only is it not reporting the good bits of social media that we've spent, you know, 5 years trying to do, but are actively, a lot of right-wing main media is actively creating the conditions for extremism to flourish and to be normalized. I mean, the debates in Australia as a result of, I mean, the guy who was responsible for the killings in New Zealand was an Australian. And the debates in that country now about the fact that it's not just about social media, it's actually about main media. Main media needs to be accountable for the extent to which it is now possible that a senator, an Australian senator, can write a press release the day after that horrific event and basically find a way of justifying it. Now, you've got main media that has normalized these kinds of conditions in ways that are just as culpable as the Zuckerbergs of the world. Murdoch is just as culpable as Zuckerberg for what we face today.
Whoa. So this is, we're a little bit, after all that positive stuff, we're into the like deep social change. I hear you on the mainstream media pointing the finger, being really good at pointing the finger and having a hard time acknowledging its own responsibility.
Well, main media is very invested, and I mentioned Murdoch in particular, the News Corporation, because they've been going after the platforms for years, yeah. Because they're eating their lunch in terms of news. So there's a very strong commercial reason why Murdoch is, and News Corp and other interests like him, are piling in on platforms. It's a perfect storm. They've got every reason to be piled in on, but be careful of who you're allied with. Be careful of the fact that Elizabeth Warren and Rupert Murdoch are both calling at mm-hmm. the same time for divestiture and antitrust. What does that tell us?
So at the risk of whiplash here, just because I want us to go out on perhaps a little bit there, you know, again, our work has also identified the work of, for example, we know about the Vlog Brothers and Project for Awesome and years of their harnessing their communities and creators throughout their Nerdfighter community to advocate for social issues. Markiplier has year after year after year promoted social issues alongside building a very, very sustainable business. Jerome Jarret, who blew up on Snapchat, launched something called Love Army that has been extraordinary at conducting interventions into not only raising money for global crises, but then going in on the ground and helping those communities, diasporic, refugee, very blighted and marginalized and suffering communities who are also sitting with a cell phone, understand that this technology may also be a lifeline and a means for not only advocacy, but even putting food on their table. And if you look at the work, I hesitate to mention it because YouTube put a ring around it, but they've recognized the fact that there are hundreds of creators out there who see themselves very much as having a twined role to play at not only creating a sustainable career for themselves, but also representing the concerns that their generation, their community, their platforms, and their audience and fans all are screaming for and championing. And we just want to raise some awareness to these conditions while at the same time very firmly espousing a call for a dire need for a greater awareness of what's going on around media and tech.
Perhaps we should quit while we're ahead then. But you guys have been extraordinary in mapping out this territory for us and helping us to understand some of its implications.
I'm really excited to see what your next steps.
Thank you.
So I really enjoyed this conversation with David and Stuart. Of course, I love those guys to begin with, but what they're doing is so very interesting. And the first thing that jumped out at me was just how you see really interesting cultural production, power accretion happening in these either countercultures or subcultures, right? Places where the mainstream either thinks there's not much there, like games or like rock and roll or computer clubhouses, or as it happens on YouTube and other platforms. And so the idea that these things which might be derided by other power brokers and the mainstream as kind of uninteresting and backwaters actually are these really vibrant places where people are finding their voices, finding their communities, and starting to take action. And it was a direct invocation of our friend and colleague Ethan Zuckerman's work on the cute cats theory, this idea that things which are created in many respects, like YouTube, to share pictures of cute cats, soon find their way into the hands of activists and other change agents.
So, and I think because the rules are not well defined yet about what social media entertainment is, and the boundaries between genres are very fluid, that we're seeing this bottom-up form move rapidly from, say, makeup tutorials to politics, right? And we've traced in some of our research the story of an American Muslim girl who starts out making makeup tutorials for women of color, and who's not a traditional beauty. She's a bit on the large side. But there she finds her voice and starts to articulate a different notion of beauty culture. Mm-hmm. And then very recently, she started speaking out against Islamophobia in the United States and took this huge step of becoming deeply political in the ways in which she talked about the world. And she really calls out some of the experiences of social ostracism she received as an American Muslim. And because of that, she got invited to be a commentator on some of the debates in the 2016 election for Univision. So there's this kind of process where she moved from finding her voice to finding her community, to using that platform for political speech, to becoming part of a larger conversation through mass media in the society. And those movements are possible. But I was struck that Stuart and David were saying many of the new YouTube celebs don't want to go into Hollywood or the established entertainment. They find more power on the edge, more power speaking through social media entertainment platforms.
So first of all, that's an amazing story. And I love that, you know, where you begin doesn't mean where you're going to end, right? It's about getting a toehold and then starting to kind of find your voice and figure out, and that sort of experimentation that we heard about in conjunction, the daily experimentation in conjunction and collaboration with the community that allows her to find different issues and to engage on those issues and to feel comfort and grow her capacity to. So I think that's an amazing story. On the second, I mean, it does makes me think a bit of podcasting, which we've just talked about a bunch in recent weeks, where initially, you know, PRX and others like them were interested in helping independent producers get onto the air because it was all about the radio, which was, you know, has scarce bandwidth and availability to be, you know, there's only so many slots and so on. And over time, people, I think, realized that's fine, but that's not really the goal. And I think that's the same thing here, is that these folks who have infinitely more freedom and brand alignment because they get to be, you know, they get to be their brand, whoever they perceive that to be, and to engage with their community directly without all these filters. And it seems like there's enough, you know, supports. Well, for the more successful folks, enough supports, right, where they can continue to create and have that freedom and autonomy to do so. I mean, I think Stuart also raises the challenge of, and David too, of the economic precariousness of, and the hard work, the burnout by your 20s, the difficulty around whether it is health insurance or a change in the way that platforms work, that on one hand, they like that independence, but on the other hand, there are some real gaps in terms of supports to ensure that they're able to do that well and over time.
So I was struck, the Saturday Night Live recently did a skit about the college admissions scandals. And has a segment where Lori Loughlin is in prison trying to be tough for the other inmates about how crazy her crimes are. And she goes through how she spent all this money to get her daughter into USC. And the prisoners are laughing about USC. They ask her what she majors in, and she explains communication, which is another laugh
Amazing.
Point.
Amazing.
And the final kicker about how absurd the whole thing is she says, and her new job is a social media influencer. So there's a sense of being funny, this idea. But in fact, I would be happy to see my son or daughter become a social media influencer because of the social power and political power, the money at stake. But the question is, would I be ready to give them the support that they need to guide themselves through this complex system that we were hearing about, where they have to negotiate between brands, communities, the construction of their image, where they're the ones on display every day out there on social media, and criticisms come in at an alarming rate, a devastating rate, and many of them are unprepared for the kinds of challenges they're confronting. So it's not a joke at all, I think, Saturday Night Live aside. It is something that has both enormous potentials and enormous risks for the people who are involved with it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, the kind of nascent state of the collective community, not the individual, you know, sort of sub community, but rather all these different creators who are in some sense in a similar boat, even if they may view themselves as very different or have different practices or areas of focus. As noted, the Internet Creators Guild has like 1,000 members or something like that. We have one of our fellows right now, Akilah Hughes, who's a YouTube personality, a comedian, a bunch of different things, as a lot of these folks are, trying to think about how do we organize people together to kind of advocate for our rights or our interests, or even to understand what those interests and rights might be. So it seems to me that there's sort of an opportunity and a challenge to come together and ask some of those questions, and then to get to and actually roll up the sleeves to do some work to ensure that those interests are known by others who make policy, whether in companies or governments or elsewhere, and to protect for them, right?
And I think Stuart and David are perfect guides for us through that. I mean, Stuart's experience as someone who thinks deeply about policy questions and has thought a lot about globalization. David's background as both an activist and someone who has worked within the media industries. You combine together in this kind of cultural odd couple of cultural studies, this mix of skills and knowledges we need. And their willingness to trace that story globally as it moves beyond Silicon Valley and Hollywood to Mumbai, to China, to Brazil, to Australia, to the Arab world. Their movement through space allows them to connect things together in the kind of fluid way that this new social media entertainment system works. And finally, I'd point to the ambivalence that I think is very much there, especially in their closing remarks in this interview, because they see the potential. This is a celebration of grassroots participatory culture at work, and yet at the same time, they see the dangers and the need for advocacy. And so coming out of this is not just a book, but a policy gathering, a variety of interventions that are designed to help reshape the social media entertainment realm. So this is the power of a cultural studies approach at work, I think.
Yeah, and I think yes to everything you said, and I'm particularly taken by their commitment to engaging with the communities of practice that they're studying, right? So they're not trying to do it as outside academics who are telling people what they should do or think, but rather they're really trying to be inclusive and ensure that the folks that they're writing about and thinking about have a seat at the table and are guiding, in many respects, the conversation. So I think it's a pretty remarkable partnership between them and among the broader community that they're forming.
So this is definitely something people should be keeping an eye on, because I think their argument is that social media entertainment is where the new entertainment realm is going and already shaping a lot of the things we're seeing, even if we never get anywhere near YouTube.
Yeah, and I just want to note one thing, as they point out, it's not just YouTube, right? It's a variety of platforms. And two, I think the global nature of it, and indeed in just this quick conversation that we've had, ties a bunch of those things together, right? Like, clearly what's happening in China, as is in many fronts, really remarkable. And what's happening, I think, in a lot of those countries leads what's happening in the United States. We are still interested perhaps in getting into Hollywood or kind of more traditional media fora, whereas in a lot of places, there was never any hope of that. And I think they're going straight to the people, right? So I think there's a lot to be learned. This is, as a global phenomenon, what's remarkable here is that the sort of practices and ideas are flowing in every which way, in all kinds of directions, which make it especially exciting. So thank you, Henry.
Thank you. To be continued.